Looking back over the last 20 years, how have refugee populations changed?
The numbers tell the story. There's much more forced displacement. So 20 years ago, in 2004, UNHCR was reporting 13.2 million refugees worldwide. So today, the equivalent figure is around 43 million. But that's not all. Refugees are people who have fled their country. The work UNHCR does also encompasses people who are still in their countries. So you put all these numbers together and you have today 117 million forcibly displaced people worldwide. So you can think of that as being equivalent to the population of Japan. I think the question that people often ask is so why is this happening? Why is this new century, the 21st century, looking so alarming, so worrying compared to the last? And why are all these people fleeing? I think the answer to that lies in the more than 55 conflicts raging globally at the moment, in the $2.5 trillion in arms spending, in military spending. That's a record amount. It also, of course, lies with rising climate vulnerability, countries not working together. If we're to address this, we really do need a massive international push for peace, stabilization, unity, and much more humanitarian support.
And just on that, do you think member states are increasingly acting with impunity and not fully using diplomatic channels, as recently stated by the USG for OCHA, Martin Griffiths, at his press conference in New York?
I think there's a couple of metrics here that are worth looking at. The first one is deaths of aid workers, and we've seen these in record numbers in Gaza, in Ukraine, in Afghanistan, in Idlib, in Syria, in Khartoum, and elsewhere. Depending on whose figures you look at, around 260 deaths last year, the majority of those being in the occupied Palestinian territories. Then a second metric is attacks on hospitals, schools, densely populated areas, civilians, where civilians are. In Gaza alone, nearly 7 out of 10 UNRWA schools have been hit. Only days ago, we all saw the news in Ukraine of Ukraine's biggest children's hospital being blown up. The danger, of course, is that such events are becoming so frequent that they're becoming normalized and without consequences for perpetrators. And that, one can argue, is a textbook definition of impunity. So I think here, you know, it's important that we get people back to talking, not fighting. Diplomacy and dialogue, cooperation, not this blind competition that we're seeing in many places. And that, of course, is the thinking in the Secretary General's new agenda for peace. It's the thinking in the Summit of the Future, which is happening in September of this year. If you don't know these initiatives, the key to understand is that they're important, really important, and that they need supporting safety chutes, if you like, for a world that feels like it's in free fall.
And so with what you just said, that tends to agree with what your own Undersecretary General, Filippo Grandi, said to the Security Council in May, that non-compliance of international law is a factor.
Yes. Well, attacks on civilians, killing of aid workers, rape and sexual violence as a weapon of war, rocketing of cities. I mean, the list goes on. Crimes against humanity, war crimes, violation of the Charter of the UN. So when High Commissioner Grandi was speaking in May to the Security Council, he reminded them of, through a plea for unity, for council members to exercise a unified voice for peace, not a cacophony of opposing voices, as he put it. And I think there was real frustration underlying that message. Humanitarians aren't people who are distant observers of war. Ask anyone in the organization I work for, UNHCR, or any aid worker who's worked in a conflict zone. No one goes into a war zone and comes out quite the same person. You see the impact of what's going wrong close up.
And getting to the refugee population themselves, what are some of the myths and mis- and disinformation perpetuated by some sectors about refugees?
There are always myths about refugees, and quite a lot of them. In my work, I've seen refugees welcomed. I've seen, though, refugees also beaten up, returned, refugees accused of bringing disease, of jumping queues, of being fighters or terrorists posing as people seeking asylum, or just being risks to national security. Now, most of this, most of the fear-mongering really is complete hogwash. Think of this, think of the following. Refugees in a world that has wars and persecution are inevitable. And they're also inevitable in a world in which countries define themselves on the basis of borders, of who is an outsider, who is an insider. So any of us can be a refugee. That's you, me, our families, anyone. Refugees is really, I think, best thought of simply as a word for people, people who happen to be displaced because of persecution by war or conflict, and people who need help. So we have a choice. We can stoke myths, or we could get on with dealing with the realities. And those realities could be complex, but the answer lies in doing that complex work.
And in the Pacific, where you are now working, what do they, does this area have its particular challenges and therefore its solutions?
Yeah, outside of Papua New Guinea, and Papua New Guinea is the largest refugee population in the Pacific region. That's the West Papuan refugees. But outside of there, many of the Pacific small island countries have very little experience of receiving refugees from outside the region. Part of this is, of course, because these islands are physically very far away from other countries, from regions of the world in conflict. Today, however, there's rising secondary displacement, meaning people who flee their country into one and they can't be sustained there, so they move elsewhere. So even the remotest countries in the world need help, help in place. And that includes, because of the context we all face, of rising climate displacement risk. So I think at UNHCR, we talk about this as being protection safeguards, putting protection safeguards in place. But it's also common sense preparedness for an uncertain future in which climate displacement looks set to rise. So that's the work we're doing, is trying to build and help those systems to be strengthened.
And just on a from a global perspective now, do you think member states are always looking for the easier way out in terms of assisting refugees? And if so, if one member state implements a refugee policy that doesn't comply with international law, but it's easier, does that create a domino effect by others? And if so, are there examples?
Well, positive examples of refugee protection are abundant. Here in Australia and New Zealand, for example, or in Canada, we have amazing expertise in refugee settlement, something that many other countries are keen to learn from. And these positive examples are essential when you work with refugees. Many of these were showcased internationally in December of 2023 at the world's biggest refugee gathering. That's the Global Refugee Forum. And let me give you an example of some of the stuff that goes on, which is quite interesting. The recent development is in Kenya, where there's a lot of interest in a new initiative known as the Shirika Plan, which means transitioning these huge refugee settlements and camps, places like Kakuma and Dadaab, into open urban settlements.
How many people are in those camps, just so we have an idea?
We're talking many scores of thousands of people. I don't have the exact numbers to give to you right now, but these are camps that have hosted hundreds of thousands of people over the years. So, you know, imagine what that could mean for Kenya, for people who live in these places, and for, you know, for an interesting area for exploration by other countries too. To come back to your question, of course, there's also negative examples too.
Negative. Can we explore the positive a little bit more in terms of turning their camps into a more of an urban centre? What type of things were looked into there? Were like turning them into small towns with proper facilities or
correct
examples?
So we're talking here about, I think, development of these, looking at making these more open places so you could interact with the community, so that the economies of these big camps can be open to others. So it's almost, if you like, developing of new towns and, you know, for refugees or populated largely by refugees. in Kenya. So it's a very positive response to a problem of camps that have been around for decades, that have seen generational refugees living there, and which give a kind of win-win for everyone. With a thriving urban settlement, you're going to get all the things that go with that. And there's a lot of benefits in that, which is why most people in the world, of course, come to urban areas.
And the negative?
The negative, well, there's no shortage of bad examples of refugee protection too. UNHCR's views, and you know, I'm here in Australia talking to you and I'm the representative for Australia, but UNHCR's views on Australia's deterrence regime over the past couple of decades, the pushbacks of boats carrying asylum seekers, offshore processing, as it's called, immigration detention over long periods of time, and the views on this are a matter of public record. That this model is being looked at by other countries in the world is politics that, frankly, has really nothing to do with protecting refugees.
And is there, you mentioned it slightly, and that there is a productive and economic argument supporting refugees in places like in Kenya. But overall, in most countries where there are large populations of refugees, is there an economic argument to support?
You know? There are many economic arguments. Refugees, for example, they tend to show higher rates of entrepreneurship, relevant, you know, in comparison to host communities they often are part of. They build economies. Here in Australia, practically many build houses, as that's a sector where many refugees are employed. They bring energy, initiative, ideas, resilience by the bucketful. You can think of some of the names in the refugee world that have become quite famous. The ones often mentioned: Einstein, Marc Chagall, or Anish Kapoor, MIA, Gloria Estefan, Freddie Mercury. There's many more. There's also here in Australia many refugee leaders, politicians, in the community. And you take a visit to any art museum around Australia here, almost always you will find artworks done by prominent refugees or telling the story of refugees. So there's plenty there. I think the question here, when it comes down to the economic benefits, is whether people listen to economic arguments or success stories. And I don't think they always do. When it comes to refugees, people who, as you know, a refugee, what is our stereotypical image of a refugee? It's often someone who looks poor or different, or maybe arriving with barely more than the clothes on their backs. In working, I think in this area, it's often more about hearts and minds than looking at the economics and the arguments there. Of course, countries should comply and uphold their international obligations, including to people who are poor, people who may have acute vulnerabilities or needs, including health needs or recovery from trauma and so on. Where the countries do, of course, is another matter.
You mentioned storytelling in your previous answer. From your own life and from your own stories, can you give an example of refugees or a refugee family or group that has inspired you and exemplifies the strengths and depths of the human spirit?
Well, you know, there's so many stories. I don't know that I have particularly one that stands out, but one that comes to mind as we're talking today is a friend of mine, an Afghan refugee in Melbourne called Wali. 3 years ago in August, when the Taliban took over in Kabul, he and his wife and children were there in Kabul. They were trying to get to the airport where evacuations were happening, and it was frankly too dangerous. He couldn't get through the crowds. There was, as you know, there was shootings. There was a horrific explosion there in the midst of this all, many armed people. So that night, and in the nights that followed, he moved with his family from house to house with nothing but a car battery to power his laptop. And using that laptop, he managed to fill in forms of, I think they were 30 pages a piece, for visas to Australia. And that worked out. But all that time, he was waiting for a knock at the door that he feared would be the end. So where is Wadi today? And I saw him recently. He has a full-time job. He's an active community volunteer. He also has a second job as an Uber driver. His two children, one of them has learning difficulties. They're both in nearby schools and doing well. This year, he finally had saved enough from his work since 2021 to put down a down payment on a house, which they've recently moved into. So I think that's an incredible journey over a short space of time. You know, you try doing something like that, or any of us try doing something like that from zero in just 3 years. I'm not sure I could. But I do, you know, his is a story that I know well, and it's one of countless examples I've seen that really constantly amaze when you see what you're dealing with refugees, people finding a way out of incredible adversity, and they do find ways.
Lastly, Adrian, any reflections or any anecdotes from the field that illustrates UNHCR's work, its importance, its human value, and any overall thoughts as you prepare to leave the organisation?
Well, thank you for asking. You know, Julia, I'm leaving UNHCR, but I'm not leaving human rights, refugee rights. I think when you work in these areas, it's not really possible to do so. I began my own career as a journalist in Hong Kong quite a number of years ago. I was reporting on Vietnamese refugees who were there at the time. I've been fortunate enough to live and work in 13 countries, Africa, Asia, Europe, China, the US. I've been in conflict zones, spent years in conflict zones. I've also been in countries at peace. I was even UNHCR's spokesperson for a while. You know, just imagine that someone let me do that. But it was a lot of fun at the time. And as for UNHCR, remember, I think that the best developments for protecting refugees tends to be born out of tough times. Fridtjof Nansen, he was a Norwegian explorer and diplomat. He became the first High Commissioner for Refugees about 100 years ago, just in the years after World War I. Then, a few years later, the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Refugee Convention, UNHCR itself, these were all created in the aftermath of World War II. Today, we've got a lot else. There's been the Global Compact on Refugees that came about in 2018, along with the Global Compact on Migration. And these were responses to big arrivals of refugees happening, including in Europe at that time. And there's quite a lot that's exciting in these developments. And I think the most inspiring thing for many of us is actually seeing the way that today in which refugees themselves are increasingly stepping forward. They're being given space to step forward and play a part in this. And really, they're proving to be the greatest strengths, I think, in the refugee world. They and the communities, of course, that refugees lie in. That's really working from the ground up is really where the best stuff often happens. So if anyone listening to this is still there at this point, if they're young, if they want to come and work in this world and do something about it to make it better, you'll not have a dull life if you come and work at UNHCR or working with refugees in any context. I think working with refugees doesn't make for dull times. That's pretty much something I can guarantee.